Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are. This week, again, the first-time jobless claims in the country are down. Did I mention again? Don't ask, leave me alone, don't tell, and don't even mention it. It is the operative law again, as of this morning. The good news is that only top officials in the Department of Defense can expel someone from the military for their gayness. The Know Nothing Party, known in its modern version as the Tea Party, is very upset about the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bailouts by the federal government and the possibility that there may have to be more. That's partly because they don't know what Fannie and Freddie are, but that's okay. They also don't know what cap and trade is, or what is and isn't in the health care plan that Congress passed. Come to think of it, they also don't know feces. Christine O'Donnell, who's not a witch but is a certified moron, with apologies to the actual morons I unintentionally demean, asked a question the other night about the separation of church and state, and she was ridiculed. But actually, she was kind of right. Even a broken clock is right twice a day. A new study demonstrates that consumption of soy foods reduces the recurrence of breast cancer. Expect a synthetic drug momentarily. There may also be a contest to name it. Start thinking. A group's ads have been removed from Spanish language radio and television. Their message to Hispanics? Don't vote. You've been taken for granted by Democrats for too long. Who could possibly have placed that ad? Bob Guccione has died at age 79 of cancer. If you don't know who he was, you're either pretty young, or you spent your life in the monastery, or you're old enough that you've forgotten. We'll fill in the gaps. Haiti, the poorest country in the hemisphere, now has something new to deal with. A diarrhea outbreak that's killed 12 people and nauseated thousands more. In Connecticut, Blumenthal widens the gap over Republican CEO of World Wrestling Enterprises to 18 points. Why can't we have more candidates like Linda McMahon running throughout the country? Oh, we do? Okay. A recent Gallup poll shows that former President Bill Clinton has more influence on voters than President Obama. Have any thoughts on why that might be the case? Frankly, I do. And speaking of highly intelligent candidates for office, Republican Carl Paladino, who's running for governor of New York, says that one person and one person alone is responsible for the housing bubble that led to the economic disaster that began at the end of George Bush's term as president. George Bush? Nope. Barack Obama? Better guess, but still no cigar. How about Paladino's opponent, Andrew Cuomo? That's what Paladino said. It seems that from 1997 to 2001, Cuomo, son of the former governor, was head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The crash of the housing market? 2008, maybe, more like 2009. That Cuomo is one powerful guy. Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. That would be me. All that, news of the weird, this week in history, our guest, journalist Mary Buttinger, talking about recent findings relating to, among other things, thermography and mammography. And, of course, our final announcement tonight, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But I also want to invite you, and I may end up doing it again during the show, to visit the blog that I write with regard to insurance and other things. It's called Insurance and More, az.blogspot.com. AZ as in the abbreviation for Arizona. Again, that's Insurance and More, az.blogspot.com. And let me talk about these items in the news, and then we'll talk about this being our final show. And, of course, we also have, tonight the our guest, Mary Buttinger, as mentioned. And assuming you can still hear me, we just had a technical glitch. I'm assuming I'm still hearable, audible, I guess is the right word. And as I said, we'll be having our guest who's going to be talking about thermography and mammography, the differences and why one is better and one is, now this is my judgment, horrible. In any event, we are back on if we were off, so hello again. The economy is improving, not as rapidly as anybody would like, although I imagine the Republicans are pretty happy with the slow pace of the recovery, because that is the one thing that is benefiting them in the election coming up, other than their high level of intellect. And, of course, not all Republicans are stupid, only the ones running for office. We mentioned that the first-time jobless claims are down. Now, that's not the same as saying the unemployment rate is down, because it isn't, or if it is, it's very slight. But first-time jobless claims are another measure of how the economy is improving. And since the jobless claims have been going down and the moving average has been going down, that's a sign of an improvement. But it's, again, not the same as a total improvement, total remedy. And it's also not the same as the unemployment level going down. But it has improved. And, of course, Obama is getting no credit for that. The stimulus is getting no credit for that. And the Democrats are going to get hurt to some degree, no matter what, in the election that's coming up in about 2 weeks. That's November 2nd, which reminds me, let me please urge you to vote on November 2nd. The more people who vote, the better Democrats will do. If that's not your thing, if you'd rather the Democrats don't do well, of course, don't vote. We also mentioned the don't ask, don't tell. In brief, a federal judge, a district court judge, had ruled that the don't ask, don't tell policy is unconstitutional and also ordered that such practices be enjoined and essentially that gays and lesbians be permitted to serve in the military unharassed, basically, or at least not harassed by the official level of the military. Office of the Solicitor General, in other words, on behalf of the Obama administration, asked for a stay, that is a delay, on that injunction. And finally, the Court of Appeals today issued that. So now Don't Ask, Don't Tell is back in place, but the Pentagon, to their credit, went ahead and issued an order that only the top levels of the Defense Department could, in fact, expel members of the military for their gayness, as I mentioned earlier. And the impression that they left is they will be reluctant to do that. And the Obama administration says that having a court make this ruling and implementing it is not as good as Congress making that rule and implementing it. The only problem is Congress may not do that. Well, we'll see what happens, obviously. excuse me. I mentioned Christine O'Donnell. Everyone's mentioning Christine O'Donnell because she's easy to make fun of and ignore the real issues that are before the country. But she said something that was actually right, sort of. In the debate she had with her Democratic rival, whose name I've obviously forgotten, I think it's Coons. In any event, excuse me, in her debate, when he mentioned the separation of church and state, she said, oh, is separation of church and state in the Constitution? And the audience, consisting primarily of law students and law school faculty, laughed at her. The fact is, the words separation of church and state, and this has long been a conservative rallying cry, there's nothing in the Constitution that specifically says that church and state shall be separated. So she wasn't completely off base. She's wrong in a real sense, but she's not wrong in terms of the wording of the Constitution. The Constitution does say that Congress, and inferentially by the incorporation doctrine, so-called, of the 14th Amendment, the states, shall make no law which essentially certifies religion or chooses a religion. But it doesn't specifically say that church and state shall be separated. The way that it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court for more than a century is that church does not, religion does not get to play a part in government, and government does not get an opportunity to play with religion. That's not to say they don't have these idiotic prayer breakfasts, but those are an exception. The government is not supposed to be involved in church activities and vice versa. The truth is, especially with the administration of George Bush and to some extent Bill Clinton, government has been supporting private and religious education, so it is not a pure situation. So though she was wrong in the essence, she was right literally. That's one of the few times that she's been right during this entire campaign, so we thought it was worth noting. We mentioned the study that shows that consumption of soy foods reduces the recurrence of breast cancer. It's not clear whether from this study doesn't treat it at all, as to whether consumption of soy foods reduces the first occurrence of breast cancer, but there is some good science to suggest that would in fact happen. If you're not eating soy foods, And especially if you're concerned about the risk of breast cancer, or for that matter, if you're not, you should be consuming more soy foods. That would be soy milk. They've got all kinds of things now. Soy nuts, soy-based cream cheese, soy-based ice cream. Though that last one I don't recommend because it's full of sugar, obviously. But all some very good stuff. Soy-based cheeses that are, in some cases, they taste like the cheeses. And soy-based meats, everything. So it's good for you. Do it. And you may also, by the way, by consuming those foods, if you're a woman, avoid a lot of the symptoms of menopause. For what it's worth, there you are. Here is something fascinating to me. A group that claims to represent Hispanics has placed some ads on Spanish language television and radio that basically starts out by saying, in Spanish, don't vote. And then goes on to say, the Democrats have been taking us for granted for too long. Instead of voting, show them our power and don't vote. Now, those aren't exact, that's not an exact translation or an exact, in fact, wording of the ad. But in the old Sherlock Holmes novels and stories, one of the questions that Holmes always asked, not always, but often asked, in terms of determining who the likely criminal was who's to gain? Who would benefit if this murder, in the case of the Holmes books, occurred? And in this situation, we are in the same place. Who would gain if Hispanics stay home outside of Florida, where Hispanics tend to be Republican? Everywhere else that Hispanics would stay home, the Republicans would obviously benefit because Hispanics are a fairly reliable Democratic voting group. One has to be suspicious of another dirty trick. It's not enough that they're spending money and contributing secretly as a result of the United Citizens case. They're also now putting these ads up where or in the media where those who are reliable Democratic blocs would perhaps in some cases not vote. Fortunately, the ads were removed by the stations. Bob Guccione, I mentioned he had died today of cancer. Bob Guccione was the creator and editor-in-chief initially of the magazine Penthouse. Penthouse was actually originally produced in England and then brought to this country. And I will tell you, having seen the first issue of Penthouse when it came out, I was a teenager, I think, it was really somewhat daring in its day in that it was much bolder than Playboy. Not just in terms of the pictures. That's, you know, if you like that sort of thing, and when I was a teenage boy, I did. But if you like that sort of thing, that's fine. But it was also much bolder in terms of its articles, in terms of what amounted to some muckraking journalism. And I don't even know if the magazine is still published, frankly, but in its day, it was really a major event. Again, not just in terms of light-level porn, but specifically in terms of its journalism, and it was really quite good. That's, I guess, my way of telling you that I only read Playboy for the interview and the jokes and the cartoons. But in the case of Penthouse, there really was some very good journalism in it. The Gallup poll that we mentioned, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, which one will have more influence on your vote on November 2nd? Clinton won that question, Bill Clinton. Why? Well, there's a couple of possibilities. One, of course, is that Obama is the president now. We're having tough economic times, and when Clinton was president, we didn't. We had good economic times. But I think the more salient reason is something more insidious. I think it's racism. Bill Clinton, although I always thought of him as a rather conservative Democrat, and I think of Obama as maybe a slightly more liberal Democrat, but essentially the conservatives, the Republicans, see, and of course the Tea Party know-nothings, have always seen Bill Clinton as a far-left president. And therefore, the people on the right certainly don't like Clinton generally at all, and the people on the right don't like Obama at all. But in terms of people having an influence on your vote, Clinton is more like you, so if you're white. So he's more likely to influence your vote. Now, if you don't think there's any bias in this country, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, but let me mention it again. If you don't think there's bias in this country, think about this. There are people often refer to the Fortune 500. If you look at the Fortune 500 and look at the CEOs, Now, these are the top 500 companies in the country as a result of income, revenue, and so forth. Of the Fortune 500, how many CEOs are African American? The answer, when I last checked, was 2. I don't mean 2%. I don't mean 200. I mean 2. 2 of 500 is something, let's see, 5 of 500 would be 1%. So that's slightly less than, it's actually 0.4%. 0.4% of all, okay. And the population of the United States is about 11% African American. Now, I'm not talking about the prospect of having quotas for CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. That's an entirely different question and a stupid one. But if that's the case, if the disparity is so great between population percentage and CEO percentage, there can only be a couple of reasons. And I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying that the first one is right, because the first one is not right. But in terms of logical progression, the first answer would be is that African Americans are inherently less capable of being a CEO of a major company. That's logical, but it's wrong. The second reason is because the reason that so few African Americans as a percentage are members, are CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, is simply because of either past or present, or both, racism. If you can think of another reason, we'd love to hear it. By the way, that allows me to invite you to call 347-994-3796. We also are due to be joined in about 8 minutes by our guest, who is Mary Buttinger, who is a journalist who has written on a variety of subjects, but has also co-authored or has authored a book with regard to mammography and thermography, more importantly. And we'll talk about a little more of that in a little bit. But I wanted to talk, before we go on to News of the Weird and this day in history and this week in history, I want to talk about the fact that tonight is our last night. Tonight is our last show. If you're listening to this in archives and you're listening during the day, today is our last show. But this evening is our last live presentation, and the reason, which I mentioned last week, but I realize that every week we have a different group, some of the same folks and some different ones, is because, frankly, preparing the show and doing the show, well, doing the show is a joy. Preparing the show is a chore, but it's fun. But the combination of those things is just too much of a time consumer for me now. And as some of you know, I am an insurance agent, and the insurance agency requires more time than I've been able to give it, partly because of the show. So as much fun as the show has been, we've done it over a year, and it really has been a lot of fun. It's mostly been fun because of the different people I've had the opportunity to have on the air with me. Occasionally a caller, but more commonly I'm referring to the guests. We've had a professor from Rice University. We've had a city councilman from North Carolina. We've had a number of authors. We've had an economist. I know I'm going to forget some people. Oh, and our most frequent guest, sorry, Larry, our most frequent guest has been Larry Hancock, who's written the books on the Kennedy and King assassinations, whom I never would have had contact with but for this show. And there's Joe Traum, and there's Sabella Giarello, a number of people I'm going to forget. Morgan St. James had just an enormous number of really terrific people, and we've also had some others. But by and large, it's been a joy doing that. So tonight is the last show, and we're not signing off yet. In about 6 minutes, we're going to be joined by our guest. But in case there's no time at the end, I just wanted to thank those of you who have listened for having done so. We may at some point return either to broadcast radio or to Blog Talk Radio. One of the things I found interesting is in looking for other shows of this type, as both a listener and just because of my interest in the medium, there are almost no shows like this. There's a possible joke there, but the fact is that there are shows on specific subjects, and there are shows that have a political bent, but it's almost entirely the host just talking. And as interesting as I may find myself, I don't have the illusion that someone could listen to me for an hour and be fascinated. but or perhaps I should have said delusion. But nonetheless, the interviews, in my opinion, make the show. I know there are people who don't agree with that, but most of their friends of mine who actually like listening to me, and both of them have said that they often don't listen to the interviews. But that said, my opinion is that's more interesting than having me talk. But the point of all this is that we've had a great opportunity, and though I will miss the show to some extent, frankly, I'm also eager to be done. But we do have tonight. When I say I'm anxious to be done, I don't mean it that way. I'm just anxious to be able to spend more time doing that, which I need to do. Anyway, enough of that. Let's talk about News of the Weird before we are joined by Mary. This comes from newsoftheweird.blogspot.com, and even after the show is over, you can of course go there. You can also go to insuranceandmoreaz.blogspot.com for my blog that relates to that. That I'm going to keep doing. Anyway, now on display in Zurich is a bar of soap that a Swiss artist says is made from the liposuctioned fat of Italian Prime Minister Berlusconi. All employees of the Italian government will please wash their hands after using the bathroom, and especially after washing their hands. In the loser criminal category was a would-be convenience store robber here in Arizona, as a matter of fact. Instead of using pantyhose over the face or an old-fashioned nylon stocking, he decided to use a clear plastic bag. Unfortunately, and as you may have guessed, putting a plastic bag over your head can cause a bit of a breathing problem. Fearful of suffocation, he ripped off the plastic right in front of the surveillance camera. Go with you. Anyway, this day in history and this week in history, while we're waiting, on October 21st, that's today's date, but in 1910, 100 years ago, a bomb went off in the building of the L.A. Times. In those days, there really were socialists and anarchists. This case eventually involved and ensnared Clarence Darrow. There's a lot more to talk about in this week in history, but I find this story particularly interesting. Several years after the event, police arrested and charged people that were known as the McNamara brothers, who in fact were brothers, with the crime of planning and, placing the bomb. Darrow, who, for those of you who don't know, was a famous lawyer and represented people who were really kind of lost causes, Darrow represented them, and I believe they were convicted anyway. I don't know if they were convicted or not. I don't recall. But what I do know is that because of that trial in which Darrow represented the McNamara brothers, Darrow was accused of jury tampering in that case, and he was acquitted eventually. But he was accused of jury tampering, as indicated, and though his own autobiography doesn't spell it out, he was represented by an attorney in California who was named Earl Rogers, a name no longer known much, but he was a famous lawyer in California. This is going back to the early years of the 20th century, although I think Rogers probably practiced until about the 1950s. And Earl Rogers had a daughter who wrote the story of his life, who was a famous journalist in her day. She too is no longer living. Her name was Adela Rogers St. John. And Rogers, of course, was the name of her father. And she wrote a book about her father's life, which, if memory serves, was called Never Plead Guilty. That's a very long wind-around from the story of the bombing of the Los Angeles Times, but it involved all those connections. I thought you might find that interesting. And if you don't, of course, don't tune in next week. Also on this day, October 21st, was the year of birth for the late Dizzy Gillespie, a jazz artist that I know all of you have heard of. The year was 1917. Also on this date, President Warren Harding publicly condemned lynching. The year was 1921. In those days, Republicans were against it. Tomorrow's date, the 22nd, was the actual beginning of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The year was 1962. And this week in history includes yesterday's date, October 20th, Congress ratified the Louisiana Purchase. The date of that, both the ratification and the purchase, was 1803. The president had the last name of Jefferson, and Congress had to ratify it because it resulted from a treaty. Speaking of treaties and ratification, while we're waiting, I probably won't get all of this in, but in the Constitution, which, of course, some of these nuts say they're in favor of, we're all in favor of the Constitution, but it's important to understand it. Anyway, according to the Constitution, the highest law, of course, is the Constitution. Beneath that are treaties. That is immediately beneath that. If a treaty has been ratified by Congress, and it takes two-thirds of Congress, I believe, to ratify a treaty, it is the highest law of the land unless it's in conflict with the Constitution, as determined by the U.S. Supreme Court. But if there is no such conflict, the treaty stands right beneath the Constitution. Then it's federal law and state law. But treaties are on top of, or that is, if you will, more supreme than even federal law. The only reason that's I'm mentioning it now is because I would recommend to you the reading of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. That's Guadalupe, as you would think, and Hidalgo is H-I-D-A-L-G-O. That was a treaty ending the Mexican War, which also specified that Spanish and English would have equal places in all of the territory that was taken over by the United States following the Mexican War. So all of the English-only laws are nonsense because they're in conflict with that treaty. And we are now joined, if I got it right, by Mary Buttinger. Are you there?
Hello. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good. Well, let me tell everybody who you are. Mary Buttinger is an Emmy Award-winning journalist who has recently co-authored a book with a physician here in Arizona, Scottsdale physician Martha Grout. The book's called An Alphabet of Good Health, and it explains, among other things, that chronic diseases are reaching epidemic proportions by reason of food, chemicals, and smog, electrosmog. The book explains that the medical community is coming to a better understanding of the impact of those elements on health. And in the book, she wrote about the President's Cancer Panel report, talking about the burden of environmentally induced cancer being underestimated, talks about the grievous harms from everyday carcinogens, and a variety of other things we're going to be talking about. October, as many of you know, is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and that's the time when women are traditionally encouraged to get a mammogram. And the mammogram is the kind of radiation that was warned against by that presidential panel. So there seems to be some disparity there. Mary, you wrote the book, as indicated, with Dr. Grout. Talk to me about what a mammogram actually is. I mean, most women have a rough idea, obviously, because they've gone through a rough experience with it. But talk about mammograms and why they're not good for women.
A mammogram is an X-ray of the breast. And we know that breast tissue is very sensitive to ionizing radiation. So with each annual mammogram, you're exposing yourself to a cancer-causing substance. Also, mm-hmm. we know that with a mammogram, you're, forgive me, but you're squishing the breast between mm-hmm. two cold metal plates. And
right.
if you should have a cancerous mass within the breast, that's another danger because you've got the potential for spreading it. 22 pounds of pressure is sufficient to rupture an encapsulation around a cancerous tumor, and a mammogram uses about 42 pounds of pressure. So
right.
it was never a good screening test.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we had, but it wasn't a great screening
test. Go ahead.
Test.
Are you there, or did we lose you?
I am here.
Okay.
did you lose me?
There's a fine kettle of squid. Mary, can you hear me?
Yes, I
okay.
can.
Okay. Hopefully, if Mary can hear me, then I'm going to ask her to call us back. We'll try this again. All of a sudden, the sound died. Are you there, Mary? Okay, I'll go ahead and click off that phone. And this is a high level of engineering I'm doing, I might add. I get to push a button and a mouse click. Hopefully, she'll call right back in. This, by the way, is what happens when you sass the host. she should be joining us again in a second. Okay, hopefully that is her. Okay, Mary, are you back?
Hi, ready? I'm back.
Oh, my God. Well, I guess the call just dropped, huh?
I guess so. Suddenly you
okay,
didn't hear me.
That's right. I was saying when you were off, I said, this is what happens when you sass the host. Get cut off without any mercy. Anyway, you were saying that mammogram has always been a bad diagnostic tool.
Well, it hasn't been a great one. We know that with mammograms, the false negative reading, in other words, cancer is present, but it doesn't say that it is, ranges from 10 to 40%.
That's a bunch.
That's a bunch. You bet it's a bunch.
What about false
positives?
For
your trouble, you got a dose of radiation.
Yeah, that's right, which is cancer-producing, at least potentially. What about false positives?
A false positive means that there is no cancer present, but the test told you there was.
Yeah, well, actually, I phrased the question badly. What I meant was, are there a lot of false positives with mammograms?
Well, the false negative rate is
right.
10 to 40%. And
right.
I think what we've seen this year is a call to switch from awareness to prevention.
Right.
I was just
asking about the diagnostic tool. Obviously, it's bad because there are a lot of false negatives with mammograms. I was asking you if there was also the danger of false positives.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, that does happen.
Okay. And in terms of what you were talking about, in terms of trying to change from awareness to prevention, before we get to that, or maybe it's part and parcel, is what you're saying, of the same thing, this presidential advisory panel that suggested fewer mammograms, before we talk about even the value of having them at all versus another diagnostic tool, but was talking about, in fact, they mentioned the danger of radiation, among other things. But the question I have for you is that really part of the whole process, them recommending fewer mammograms beginning at a later age, even though it takes along the presumption of mammograms as the diagnostic tool? But was that part of this whole panoply of movement towards prevention rather than having the mammograms?
I don't think we're seeing that. What we saw in last year in November, we saw a government task force make a recommendation for fewer mammograms, particularly for women under 50, when the breast is most sensitive to radiation. And basically they were saying, you know, mammograms, again, are not a very good tool, and we think there should be less mammograms because they're detecting innocuous cancers that don't really need to be treated. That's also part of the problem with them. The American Cancer Society, however, did not decide to go with those recommendations. And just last week, the head of the American Cancer Society, Dr. Oles Broadley, was on NPR, and he discussed it at length, and he said, you know, the task force was basically trying to say that mammography is imperfect. But so many women heard something else. They heard that the new federal health care law that passed no longer wanted to spend money looking for breast cancers. And, of course, that's not what a woman wants to hear. So
there
was
a
big uproar.
And they had nothing to do with each other either. Yeah.
Pardon me?
I say they had nothing to do with each other either.
No. It was just a public recognition that mammography is imperfect. And it's time to look at some other screening technologies like thermography.
Before we get to that, I wanted to make clear something you said. You talked about mammograms finding innocuous cancers. That sounds like an oxymoron. I think I know what you mean, but why don't you go ahead and explain that?
Well, yeah, the big C is a scary word. So how could anything be innocuous? And, in fact, many cancers are. They'll either resolve on their own or never come to the point of doing damage. One of the reasons that the task force said we also need to do less prostate screening is because so many men have prostate cancer, but it is a very slow-growing cancer. And as you look at the trends in mortality, the men are going to die of something else before they ever die of the prostate cancer, so it's not worth treating it.
Yeah, there's a doctor who wrote a book, and unfortunately I can't think of his name to save my life. Perhaps a poor choice of words. But long before this advisory panel or task force came out recommending fewer PSA tests for men and fewer mammograms for women, he was talking about the fact that was the way to go. And one of the things he said is that with regard to these innocuous cancers, though I don't believe he used that phrase, he said you are more likely in that situation to die with breast cancer or prostate cancer than of it.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah.
And the treatment is not easy to go through.
Yeah. And in the case of that's true of both. In the case of prostate cancer, it can have some fairly nasty side effects.
It does reduce your quality of life. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So talk to us about thermography. What is it, and how does it work?
Thermography looks at the growth of a tumor. We know that when most tumors are growing, they form their own blood supply, they form their own network of vessels, and all of this activity gives off heat. And that heat signature is something that the thermography can pick up. It's looking at the heat on the skin, and it takes a picture and interprets it with colors. So what you're looking for is red spots in the breast, and it's not quite that simple. It takes a trained person to do these readings.
Right.
But they will look at thermographies over time. You did one 2 years ago, last year, and again this year, for example, and they will look at a questionable spot and see if there is asymmetry, if there's something that's not equal in the two breasts that suggests that there is indeed an issue going on. Thermography does not have any radiation. It's not invasive at all. It takes 15 minutes. It's a much better alternative. There's no compression of the breast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the best part of it is it can see the formation or the suspicions of formation maybe 5-10 years before the cancer gets to about the size of a pea, at which point the mammogram can pick it up. Everybody agrees that early detection is the best solution to reducing breast cancer. Thermography is clearly better at early detection. It hasn't been in political favor.
Yeah, and you're not talking about using heat or different temperatures to measure something. You're talking about measuring temperature, so that's kind of benign.
It's very benign.
Yeah.
It takes about 15 minutes, and you're standing in front of a camera, and the camera is able to, through the computer software, to take measurements of the heat on the skin temperature and translate that into pictures that can be read.
Well, this raises about 3 million questions, so let me ask a couple of them. One is, and I'll just tell you two of them right off the top, because you may want to address both of them serially. One is isn't it true that when thermography was beginning, there was a lot of belief that it was showing false positives? And the second question is, has thermography been used to detect any other kind of cancer?
Let me take that first one. Thermography, in the early 70s, there was a study, the National Cancer Institute's Breast Cancer Detection and Demonstration Project, and they sought to compare thermography, mammography, and a physical palpation type exam. And after 2 years, they tossed out the thermography, not because it was an incompetent product, but because the way that the test was formed caused an incompetent result. The protocol was one paragraph long. You didn't necessarily have to be well trained. The project sites were not set up so that they were temperature controlled. Basically, the data from it was a mess. So they said, you know, we're not going to compare it. They threw it out. And we think that it merits further investigation, but we're not going to put it in to the rest of our study. And unfortunately, the interpretation of that test so long ago by the conventional medical community was that thermography is not a good breast screening technology.
Mm-hmm.
But it has changed. So, you know, technology advances, and the protocols got straightened out, and then there were some 800 peer-reviewed studies done on thermography that showed that, yes, indeed, it is a better early detection process.
Well, isn't it true on that same level that the reason it was believed to have shown false positives is because it was showing positives that really were there, that is, there were some tumors, some cancerous tumors, but they weren't showing up on mammography, so they must be false, is the way they saw it.
Absolutely, Jeff, because the thermography picked up on the formation of it so soon, because it took several years yet for the breast cancer to materialize to a point that other technologies could see it, people thought that it had picked up a cancer that didn't exist. They didn't realize how much earlier it could pick it up.
Amazing. And the second question that I was asking you is, has this, in my two-question set, has thermography been used to attempt to detect other cancers, and if so, how successful has it been?
I'm not aware that it's been used to pick up other cancers. It's been used in pain and sports medicine to find out where inflammation is coming from.
Mm-hmm. It's much more accurate than asking the athlete, where does it hurt?
Yes, because, again, wherever you've got an injury, you've got inflammation. And technology, the technology of a thermogram will see that inflammation.
Sure, because where something is inflamed, it's warmer, definitionally. So that'll pick up the temperature difference.
Right.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question. You wrote this book with Dr. Grout. How did you get interested in the subject in the first place?
I got sick many years ago. I woke up one morning out of the blue sick, and I needed to find out what was wrong. I'd spent 2 years at Mayo Clinic. They could not find out what was wrong. They made two diagnoses. They weren't sure about either one of them. They knocked it down with a bunch of prednisone the first time because I was a walking case of inflammation, essentially.
Right.
And when it came back, they wanted to do things that are even further down the continuum, like gold shots. And I figured my body would just be a demolition derby, and I didn't want to do that. So I thought, well, you know, there's this other thing out there called alternative medicine, and I'm going to find out what it is. And so I began to work with other doctors, and I began to read an awful lot. And I decided to take my professional focus into medicine about 4 years ago, and I began working with Dr. Grout about that same time, and it just ended up where we said, you know, we should put this in a book so that everything is understandable and well-documented and people can understand that there is a wider range of choices out there than perhaps what they know about from their HMO.
Yeah.
So we wrote Alphabet of Good Health, and we wrote the first part of the book to say what really distinguishes conventional medicine from a more holistic approach is that those who practice holistically understand that a lot of what's wrong with people right now is chronic disease. 8 out of 10 times you go to a doctor's office, it's for a chronic disease. Cancer's one of them. And
arthritis,
what's driving
all
that,
the rest of them. Yeah.
Yeah, what's driving that is food and the chemicals and all of the EMF, the wireless technologies, et cetera. And if you really want to make traction, if you really want to make headway and get well, you need to work with a doctor who understands those three things.
Okay,
so the first section
true.
Of the book talks about that, and then the second section of the book talks about a variety of common health topics that people want to know about, allergies, autoimmune diseases, autism, cancer, heart disease, et cetera. And we talk about it in context of how to respect the body's healing process. So often, for example, with breast cancer, all right, we're going to give you a bunch of chemotherapy, which is going to pretty much knock out what's remaining of your immune system. Because cancer,
absolutely,
by one definition, is a failure of the immune system.
Sure.
There are alternative ways to conduct even chemotherapy. There's a process called IPT, insulin potentiated therapy, which says, you know, we know what makes cancer cells different. They run totally on sugar. So if we can put a little sugar water in your body and then put in just 1/10 the amount of chemo we normally use, that glucose is going to pretty much target and deliver, like a bullet, to just the cancer cells and pretty much bypass
all
the healthy cells.
Because the cancer wants to suck up the sugar.
Exactly. Like little Pac-Man, they're going after the sugar, and so they take the it's a Trojan horse idea, and it works wonderfully.
Right.
You use 1/10 of chemo. Patients do not lose their hair. They do not have the severe nausea. They do not have the organ damage. They don't have the negative white blood cell counts. And a lot of the doctors, like Dr. Grout, when she uses IPT, she'll always combine that with complementary therapies to rebuild the immune system.
Great.
So that you can walk out of the process with a strong one.
By complementary therapies in this context, you're referring essentially to nutrients that she provides the patients, like herbs and vitamins and things like that?
Well, chemotherapy isn't the only thing that will kill a cancer cell. We know, for
right.
example, that vitamin C will kill cancer
uh-huh.
cells. So you don't have to rely totally on the chemotherapy to do all the work for you. There's also poly-MVA,
right.
which is under clinical studies right now to be used by conventional oncology. Poly-MVA does a lot of neat things, including boosting your immune system again and killing off cancer cells.
Before you go into that, because I want to know more about that, I want to mention two things. Number one is that the book Alphabet of Good Health is available on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com, I assume, and all the usual places.
I know that it's on Amazon. Yep.
Okay, so Amazon.com called Alphabet of Good Health. Obviously, you can do the search. The authors are Budinger, B-U-D-I-N-G-E-R, and Grout, G-R-O-U-T. The second thing is, you mentioned vitamin C. Linus Pauling was one of my heroes. And Linus Pauling co-wrote a book called Vitamin C and Cancer, which was written co-written by a Canadian physician. And in addition to Mary and Dr. Grout's book, let me recommend that one to you. If you have an issue or concern about cancer, vitamin C is a wonderful substance. I don't want to go into enormous detail right now, but that's nor will I next week, isn't it? But that's something for you to look at and be aware of, even without having a cancer problem now. It's something to be aware of in advance of someone you know getting it. And tell us now what poly-MVA is.
Oh.
I don't even know what it stands for. I mean, what is it? It doesn't matter.
You're getting into complicated territory there.
Okay. Well, no, you mentioned that it was going. They were looking at using it as a protocol to help defeat cancer, or is being tested.
It's a lipoic acid palladium complex, and it defeats cancer on an energetic level, whereas vitamin C defeats it more on a chemical level. This defeats
mm-hmm.
it more on an energetic level, and it helps the liver filter out the spent chemo agents from the body.
Okay.
Glutathione is another really good complementary therapy because it is the body's number one detoxer, and when you are shedding tumor cells, when you're killing a cancer, you've got a special need to detox, and glutathione is an antioxidant that is the body's best detoxer. And so very often when you're going through cancer treatment and you're looking at complementary therapies, glutathione is another one you look at.
Huh. I've heard of glutathione, but I had no idea what it is. A display of my ignorance, of which there is plenty. I for some reason I thought it might be an amino acid, but it's not from what you're saying. It's something
no,
which
it's
just
an antioxidant that the body makes.
Okay. All right. Well, good. Tell me, you know, one of the things that I find strange. Okay, there are many, but one of the things I find strange relative to disease, cancer obviously being essentially the worst, or the worst group of diseases, is that the organized, the formal organizations don't seem to be on board with anything but the conventional, or if you will, allopathic methods of doing things. The Susan G. Komen Foundation, which is a good group, I mean, has good intentions, and many of us have participated in the runs over the years. Nonetheless, they're not really recommending thermography, are they?
No, they don't. They don't, and they have been criticized for their approach. They've had representatives from GE who make the mammography machines on their board.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. You know, that you get into medicine and you ask why, and then you start to find that the answers too many times come back to politics and money.
Yeah. And the same thing would be true, would it not, of the American Cancer Society and every other major national cancer organization, correct?
Well, entire books have blasted that, particularly Dr. Sam Epstein. We had a war on cancer launched when President Nixon was in the White House in the 70s. How are we doing? We have rates of cancer that are so much higher now than they were in the 1970s. So clearly, all the money on research, Susan G. Komen's been at this 28 years, we have a higher rate of cancer today than we did in 1970.
Well, I was going to ask you, do we in fact have a higher rate that is a higher percentage, and I don't know I assume you know the answer, but I don't. Do we in fact have a higher percentage of people who get cancer, or do we just have larger numbers because the population is larger? I mean, is it in fact a higher percentage than we used to have?
No, it's a higher percentage. When it comes to breast cancer, for example, today, it's 1 in 8 women. In 1950, it was 1 in 20.
Okay. And so then, of course, you get back to what you were talking about before, which is the reasons for the increases. It can't be smoking alone, because fewer and fewer people as a percentage of the population are smoking.
But, Jeff, you hit on something. Take a look at what we did with smoking. We told people over and over again, well, it took us 25 years, first of all, to admit that smoking was a problem. That's the politics and the money. But once that we got honest with the conversation, we told people, if you take these chemicals into your lungs, you're going to increase the chances of lung cancer. If you don't want to do that, don't smoke. So what we need to do now is to say to women with breast cancer, for example, if you don't want to increase the odds of breast cancer, you need to look around you at the carcinogens in your shampoo, in your household cleaning products. You need to take a look at the effects of cell phone radiation and wireless networks when you're sleeping, particularly. That's when your body needs to detox, and all of those unnatural energies in wireless communications interfere with your body's natural frequencies. We need to take a look at what's in our food. We're eating too many trans fats, for example, that make your cells hard to do their job properly of opening up to let the toxins out and take the nutrients in. And after a while, I think we're like a chain of links. And after a while, with all these daily stresses on us, your body says, okay, my weakest link is this one here. For someone like me, it's my joints. Someone else, it might be Crohn's disease. Someone else, it might be cancer. But your body's going to say, okay, that weakest link, whatever it is, it's broken. I'm sorry, I can't keep it running anymore.
Adios.
And then, boom, we've got a diagnosable disease. But were there signs ahead of that? Yes. We just didn't have a system of medicine that is trained to look for them and head it off at the pass.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you something. You know, there is a fairly well-known chiropractor who was actually essentially based here, who has a national radio show, Bob Martin.
Yes.
And he used to say that, you know, he may still, but he used to say that one of the things that's wrong with conventional medicine is that you'll go see your doctor, you know, presumably for an annual physical, which is another joke, and you'll go see your doctor for an annual physical, and he will say, okay, well, listen, your blood pressure is up a little bit and your blood sugar is up a little bit, but it's nothing to worry about. We'll just keep an eye on it, meaning that we'll examine it next year to see if we can prescribe a drug for it. Okay? And, you know, where it's, a lot of this is really, really simple. You know, I mean, some of it's not easy, but it's all simple. And that is, if you're being exposed to this stuff, if you're consuming the garbage, you mentioned trans fats. I would extend that, and I'm no expert, but I would extend that to overall animal fat consumption. If you're doing a lot of that stuff, putting a lot of that stuff into your body, along with the chemicals that you're mentioning that surround us and which we import through you, you mentioned the shampoo, we could add the hair dye and all the rest. The fact is that people are poisoning themselves. The electromagnetic stuff, I'm less familiar with. And I'm sure it's deliberate on an unconscious level because I use a cell phone like crazy. But as far as the, you know, all this stuff, the answers are simple. Stop eating at McDonald's seven times a week. Stop consuming garbage at home. Stop, you know, using all of these chemicals on your body and around your body. Stop cleaning with chemicals that are harmful to breathe in. You know, on and on and on. It's obvious. People don't want to accept that. They make comments like, well, everything causes cancer. No, it doesn't. Maybe everything around you because of how you've surrounded yourself.
Yeah, it's tough to make that connection because you don't use the shampoo today and get brain cancer tomorrow.
Right, right.
You don't eat the pizza today and have a problem tomorrow. It takes years for these problems to pile up. And I think also, too, Jeff, there's a part of us that doesn't want to believe that they would allow all of these carcinogens out there in the open market.
Oh, yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
they do. And
right.
what I've come to understand over the years very clearly is it's up to us consumers to make the difference. It's up to us to educate ourselves and say, we don't want this anymore. You know, there was
right.
a mommy blog that just exploded earlier this year when one of the toddler formulas came out in chocolate. And they said,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's not good. You're encouraging people to buy this toddler formula, and you're encouraging the kids to drink it because it's chocolate. Well, I was
mm-hmm.
curious what they were talking about, so I picked up a can of it, and it doesn't matter whether it's chocolate or not. It's about 50% corn syrup. Okay, Mommy
yeah.
Bob, let's get upset about feeding a two-year-old corn syrup. That's not
Absolutely.
What human beings were meant to eat.
Well, the same thing is true. I don't know if you agree with me. The same thing is true of cow's milk. Any dairy product was not really designed for humans to consume. It was designed for, you know, young cows, calves. And, you know, the fact is that if you look at all the studies of consumption of that, there are a variety of negative effects, not the least of which is probably calcium leaching. So, I mean, it's not
I
good
think
stuff.
The bigger problem with the milk, Jeff, right now is the genetically modified hormone that's
I
in
agree.
Some of these dairy products.
Yeah.
That is definitely not good for us. Definitely not good.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Well, listen, I'm going to let you go because we've only got about 2 minutes left and I want to have the time to sign off. But thank you. This has been fascinating, and I hope that particularly women will consult their doctors or go to another doctor if they're not using one now who will use thermography rather than mammography, number one. If you're in Arizona, Dr. Martha Grout is the co-author of the book written with Mary, Alphabet of Good Health, again available at Amazon.com. And Dr. Grout's last name is Grout for all of you spelling experts. And thank you, Mary, very much. It's been a pleasure having you here and having this conversation.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you. And that's almost a wrap for us. We have about 2 minutes left. I was going to mention something before and failed to, so I'll mention it now at the risk of ego. I seldom do a vanity search, and this was not a vanity search per se in that I didn't look for my own name, but I did look for the name of the show, Speaking of Everything, and there were a number of references to Howard Cosell's having done a show by that name, which is where we stole it, but that's a number of years ago for obvious reasons. He's long dead, and that was when he was doing radio shows, which is what gave the idea for the name of the show. But actually, if you look up Speaking of Everything on Google, you'll see several references to this show, which is ending in about 2 minutes. As said, we'll be ending this series. And I want to thank, of course, my lovely bride Alicia, who is not in the room now, and our lovely producer, our dog Autumn, and thank all of you. For having listened. I hope you've enjoyed it at least as much as I have. Good night, and have both a good week and, of course, a good life. Good night.